Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Can we do it?
Yes, we can, Prime Minister. And though it is not my business to say so, we must. If we do not, or if we pussyfoot in our actions and do not achieve complete success, in another few months we shall be living in a totally different country whose word will count for little. That, Dominic Sandbrook, was Mrs. Thatcher and Sir Henry Leach, the first Sea Lord, debating what to do in the wake of the capture of the Falkland Islands by an Argentine invasion force.
Tom, that was an extraordinary performance. That was, it wasn't quite on the level of your John Wayne as Genghis Khan that we had the other week, but it was up there.
Thank you. And there will be more to come over the course of this exciting series.
Are you going to be doing General Galtieri?
No, no, but there will be more Thatcher. Okay, and I'm hoping to do an Ian MacDonald as well, who was the
excellent
the Ministry of Defence spokesman.
Yeah.
So, Dominic. That was a kind of sneak preview of the reaction in London. But before we get to London and how people in the government and the opposition and the media responded to the humiliation of the loss of the Falklands, we left it on a cliffhanger. So Rex Hunt holed up in Government House and the Argentines have arrived. So what happens?
So there's the sort of hours of shooting. We left it exactly that with the governor, Rex Hunt. He's holed up. He's got his shotgun. He's actually got a pistol because his driver has got his shotgun, and the Royal Marines, and they are surrounded. There are about, I don't know, 5-10 times as many Argentine soldiers who have just landed at the beginning of in the early hours of Friday, the 2nd of April, 1982, and basically the Marines are completely outnumbered. They don't formally surrender. They don't want to do that. But he orders them, in his capacity, basically, as the governor, to lay down their weapons to avoid future bloodshed. And then we have this moment. So this is the early hours of Friday morning. And then we have this moment that we had in the first podcast in this series. The Argentines invade the little radio station that is broadcasting the news to all the people of the Falklands. They then argue among themselves. While they're doing that, Rex Hunt rings the radio station and he says, "I'm dreadfully sorry this has happened. You know, very convenient for everybody."
Show.
But he has these wonderful last lines. He says, "I'm sorry it's happened this way. This is probably the last message I'll be able to give you, but I wish you all the best of luck and rest assured that the British will be back." And of course, this sounds like empty bravado, but I think he means it. Mm. So about 10 o'clock that morning, Argentine helicopters arrive outside Government House.
And Dominic, could I actually quote Sir Rex Hunt as quoted by you in your fabulous book, Who Dares Wins? Outpoured a horde of red-hatted, gold-braided gentlemen who proceeded to hug, kiss, and embrace each other in typical Latin fashion. So I think you can see there why Sir Rex Hunt was not a top diplomat.
Why
he had to be exiled to the Falkland Islands.
But he behaves very well, Rex Hunt. So he then goes along and he's introduced. He goes to the town hall, which is now completely occupied by Argentine troops. And there is General Osvaldo Garcia, who's the commander of the occupying force. And Garcia holds out his hand. Rex Hunt describes him as a sallow little man. And Garcia holds out his hand to Hunt to shake. So the Argentines, who we described in the first podcast as being very badly behaved in their own country, sort of electrocuting people and stuff. One of the strange things is they're actually pretty chivalrous. It's very important to them that they're perceived to be chivalrous by the British.
Gentlemen.
They basically want the British to say, "Oh, well played. You know, this is a good sport."
Because Argentina is a country where that idea of the British gentleman still has some currency.
It does. It does.
Fair
absolutely.
Play, all that kind of stuff.
Yes, exactly. And there's this extraordinary thing where Garcia holds out his hand. Rex Hunt refuses to shake it. And Garcia says, "It is very ungentlemanly of you to refuse to shake my hand." And Hunt says, "Well, it's very uncivilized of you to invade my country."
Fair enough.
And then Hunt, very impressively, given that he's surrounded by men with automatic weapons, he says to this bloke, "You have landed unlawfully on British territory, and I order you to remove yourselves and your troops forthwith."
Which they don't do.
And they basically put him and his wife, Mavis, onto a
plane. What about
their
son? Presumably the son as well.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to Tony, actually. he disappears from the story. He's
get out of doing his O-levels.
Exactly. So, but Hunt, again, in the sort of 1950s Peter Sellers comedy sort of touch, so they say, we're going to put you on a plane and fly you out. He insists on getting his ceremonial sword, his hat with ostrich feathers, and he has himself driven to the airport in his red London cab with the Union Jack fluttering, and all the street, well, all the streets, I mean the one street, is kind of lined with hundreds of Falkland Islanders who are kind of clapping and crying and stuff. And he and Mavis have flown off into exile.
So, to Britain.
Eventually to Britain, yes. So that meeting that you alluded to earlier, that had actually happened 2 days previously. So in London, people had known that this was coming because they'd had intelligence that the Argentine fleet was steaming towards the Falkland Islands. You know, Margaret Thatcher's in the House of Commons. She's asked by John Knott, her defence secretary, to go to his room. He gives her the news. The room starts to fill with people. They're all absolutely ashen. And she says, we have to get these islands back. You know, when the Argentines arrive, we'll have to kick them out. And John Knott says, well, we can't. And actually the consensus, pretty much the political consensus, is we can't. And it's at that moment that the door opens and in comes the First Sea Lord, Sir Henry Leach. He's been inspecting ships. He's just heard the news. So he's still in his outfit. And he says that remark that
let's have a crack at Johnny Argy.
It's not quite that, Tom, because it's more melodramatic than that. It's more apocalyptic. He says, if we don't do it, we'll be living in a different country whose word will count for little.
Yeah. And he's the son of a commander in the Second World War.
Died on HMS Prince of Wales.
Okay, so shot sung by the Japanese.
Yeah. In what was then a sort of landmark humiliation. And Leach joined the Navy as a boy, and all his life, I think, has been, you know, it's that kind of thing that
once redemption
has daydreamed about. Yeah. And suddenly fate has delivered him a chance to you know, avenge his father, prove himself worthy of his father.
So he's head of the Navy.
Yeah.
And do the rest of the defence, the chiefs of the defence staff, do they agree?
They're all for it. They're all for it.
Okay.
And Mrs. Thatcher, I mean, we haven't really talked about her much, partly because all her interest in her first sort of 2.5 years as prime minister, all her interest has been in economic reform and her harsh economic medicine. So, you know, of course she's very into the Cold War. She's very anti-communist, all this stuff. But, you know, a war with Argentina is the last thing that has ever been on her mind. And it's an extraordinary thing, this sort of transformation that happens to her, because suddenly she is sort of transfigured into this, you know, she basically can dress up as Winston Churchill.
She's as you say, she's been very, very obsessed with economic matters, the kind of the social tensions that her economic policies have generated in Britain. But she is also a kind of very patriotic admirer of Kipling, talks about Winston, all that kind of stuff.
Winston.
Yeah. So presumably her instinct is to say, we should do this. She has the chiefs of defence who also say, yes, we can do this. But she's surrounded by Tory grandees who, as we mentioned in the first episode, all seem to have won the military cross. So are very brave, clearly very brave men with experience of military service. But the impression I get is that by and large, they are less enthusiastic about it.
I think they are, actually. I think a lot of people, when her cabinet meet, so that's on the Friday night, so after the news of the invasion has definitively happened, the cabinet agree to go for it. But I think they go for it much more reluctantly. She is all for it. She absolutely believes from the very moment the invasion breaks, she absolutely believes Britain has to do it. You know, it's as though this was the sort of, you know, Churchill famously, when he became prime minister, said, you know, all my life I'd been preparation for this trial and all this stuff. I mean, I think there's a bit of Margaret Thatcher that...
failure, do you remember what Queen Victoria once said? Failure, the possibilities do not exist.
Exactly. And as the conflict goes on, she grows in, she starts to play that part much more and more sort of self-confidently. But you're right that I think If she had said in that cabinet meeting on the Friday night, well, there are all kinds of reasons why this would be very foolish to send a task force, then I think there'd been a lot of people quite
relieved.
Some people, yeah, it was like, oh, look, I think quite a few of her ministers said, yeah, I'm quite right, Prime Minister. I mean, sensible. Let's not overdo this. Let's not escalate. Now, interestingly, the Foreign Office, who she absolutely despises as a kind of nest of appeasers, they send a preliminary assessment that night, the Friday night, that says Britain will not win international backing for using force. The United States will not support us. You know, we won't be able to persuade the British public it's worth it. It's just a complete... And to Mrs. Thatcher, she's like, what was the alternative? That a common or garden dictator should rule over the Queen's subjects and prevail by fraud and violence? Not while I was Prime Minister.
So she's saying that before the debate that is called, for the first time in many, many years, on a Saturday, since Suez. Well, that's kind of telling, isn't it?
So very
the great humiliation. And the House of Commons is summoned on a Saturday to debate what seems to be another catastrophic British humiliation.
And
I remember it vividly. I remember it vividly because we were trying to set up a cricket net in our garden.
Oh, my God.
And our garden wasn't really big enough to fit
Tom,
it
your
in.
Life is beyond parody. I mean,
I know. So... it was kind of tricky. We had to kind of work out the angle so we could just about squeeze it in. We involved going up a hill and things. It wasn't very effective. But I remember while we were struggling with the nets and the poles and everything, listening to the debate. And it was my first experience of listening to a debate in Parliament. And it couldn't have been more dramatic.
Of course. Because when she goes, people think she could fall. She could be toast.
Because it is humiliating. Yeah, it's a humiliation.
It's a
and she's answerable for it.
Yeah, absolutely. It happened on her watch. Intelligence failure happened. Now, you know, how much is she personally responsible? Well, not really.
Well, the buck stops with the Prime Minister.
But the buck stops with the Prime Minister, absolutely. So in other words, had she been in opposition and had it happened to James Callaghan or Michael Foot, she would have been the first to lead the prosecution. So it's completely reasonable that she takes the blame. She gives at first quite a tentative performance because she knows that she's going to get a lot of flak. The press that morning is awful for the government, says, mm-hmm. you know, this is the worst humiliation in British history. But there's also right away an absolute sense in the press, this is World War II. We have to fight. I mean, the Express, I always think the Express had a front page, which in a weird way, I mean, this probably says a lot about me, that I've always found quite moving, which is that they had the whole front page was a photograph taken a few years earlier. They'd managed to get every single Falkland Islander on the lawn outside Government House, and they're all waving Union Jacks and looking up, and they're being photographed from above. And so the Express ran that picture again on its front page with the headline, "Our loyal subjects, we must defend them."
So the Foreign Office had said public opinion won't be in favour of a task force.
And straight away,
public opinion is kind of swinging behind it. Now, the other key constituency, of course, is the opposition.
Yeah.
And the opposition is led by Michael Foot, who is a very distinguished political, cultural, literary figure. Wrote wonderful books on Byron and
Jonathan Swift.
Hazlitt and Swift and all kinds of things. Very, very civilized man. He's definitely on the left of the party. And so it's not immediately obvious that he is going to swing behind demands for the Falklands to be taken back. But he does. And he has this wonderful phrase you quote from him, "I know a fascist when I see one." Because as a young man, he had been very opposed to appeasement, hadn't he?
Yeah, he'd made his name with the pamphlet Guilty Men, attacking the appeasers in the late 1930s. And he sees himself as very anti-fascist. So Michael Foot gives this, Mrs. Thatcher gives a tentative speech. Michael Foot gives this absolutely blazing speech. He says the Falklanders have been faced with an act of naked, unqualified aggression carried out in the most shameful and disreputable circumstances. They have the absolute right to look to us at this moment of their desperate plight, just as they have looked to us for the past 150 years, all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the Tories love it.
They're all cheering.
Everybody's cheering. Some of his own.
But not everybody, right?
Because there are
two famous figures on the left who are opposed to it. The first,
and it will not surprise this,
and it will not surprise anyone, is an obscure left-wing MP from Islington, called Jeremy Corbyn.
All right. No, he's not MP yet. He's not an MP yet. He's about to be adopted as Labour's candidate in Islington.
And he condemns Foot as a kind of arrant imperialist and dismisses the whole idea of sending a task force as a Tory plot to keep their money-making friends in business. But of course, the standard bearer of the left in opposition to Foot is Tony Benn.
Yes, yeah, Tony Benn.
And Tony Benn comes out very, very much against it.
Michael's an absolute warmonger.
But what I learned from your book is that in 1976, when Benn himself had been in government, he wondered what would happen in the event of an Argentine invasion. And he said the total spinelessness of the Foreign Office and the general decay of Britain would prevent it being taken back. So that's quite a swing in
perspective. Exactly.
So what's going on there? Why is he...
Well, Tony Benn is on this sort of conveyor belt that is moving him ever leftwards.
So that's that it's not the reflection of the fact that he's.
Oh, but it is also the reflection of the fact. Yeah.
So there's a slight degree of hypocrisy, but it is also reflected that he's moving further to the left.
I think there is a bit of a degree of hypocrisy. Actually, I know some listeners may be great Tony Benn fans. You know, Tony Benn gets a lot of stick at this point from other people, by the way, on the left of the Labour Party. So Eric Heffer, for example, who's one of his who ought to be one of his allies, says basically. These people say to him, what is wrong with you? Can you not see that the Argentines are by our lights, we see them as fascists. We should be absolutely against them. And somebody says, you know, if we carry on with your, we'll be known as the Munich Party and all this kind of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, certainly what you have, and we can get into this maybe later on when we talk about the public and the press, is you have clearly a division, which was also there at Suez, actually, going back to what you were saying about the Saturday meeting of the House of Commons, between that part of the Labour coalition that is kind of working class Labour voters.
Set up NATO.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you have the high-minded, you know, people who live in leafy, you know, university towns. So, who are horrified by the thought of going, the very idea of going to war with anybody.
Right, and so they're not just in the Labour Party, are they? They're also you mentioned the SDP and the Liberals. So they are they've come together in an alliance. They seem to be knocking huge chunks out of both the Tories and Labour, and they're led by Roy Jenkins.
Yeah,
who
have you got a nice quote about Roy Jenkins?
I do, which I have lifted again from your book, and this is by parliamentary sketch writer called Frank Johnson.
Brilliant writer.
Every parliamentary sketch writer I know, I think Tim Stanley, who Telegraph, currently the Telegraph sketch writer, described him as the Mozart of parliamentary sketch writers, and he describes Roy Jenkins as a one man Switzerland. As prosperous, comfortable, civilized, and almost entirely landlocked, his only previous contact with the high seas had been in various good fish restaurants. Obviously, he, you know, in a slightly different way to Tony Benn, but he also is, you know, he's not suited to Nelsonian exploits and the waving of Union Jacks and things.
No, absolutely not. And I think. So what you have there is Roy Jenkins, who was a colossal figure in the imagination of the 1970s and early 1980s, because he's the absolute incarnation of kind of metropolitan liberalism and civilized, not sort of capital L left wing, but kind of mildly center left, good chaps, fine wines, restaurants in Brussels,
kind of Remainers, civilized metropolitan Remainers.
Absolutely, absolutely. He thinks this is backward. You know, it's primitive atavism to be fighting a war over faraway islands, to be waving the flag, to be sending fleets. It's vulgar. He's completely uncomfortable with it. And there are people within his own party, the SDP. So British listeners, some of them will know David Owen, for example.
Foreign Secretary.
Who is all for the Falklands War. He thinks, you know, go for it, embrace it.
David Owen's kind of blue Labour, wasn't he? I mean, that's the division.
So suddenly Mrs. Thatcher, I mean, Michael Foot has let her off the hook in the House of Commons, by the way, on the Saturday, by attacking the Argentines, really, rather than the government's intelligence failure. He's given her a bit of an opportunity. But it's clear that this is not a top-down thing at all. The public are not brainwashed. They're not led.
They're pushing for it.
The public, I mean, instantly you see it on the ground that in diaries, in actually the turnout at the docks when the task force leave, So that weekend, the task force are already mobilizing for war. They're already, you know, trucks piling into kind of Portsmouth and Southampton with equipment, people being recalled, all the ships being requisitioned. And when they leave, the quaysides are packed with
wives
people.
And girlfriends kissing, yeah. And yeah.
Yeah, people, ordinary people, they're waving flags and crying and singing, yeah, patriotic songs and all this sort of stuff. I mean,
task force does go, and there are enough ships, you know, this has happened presumably before the cuts have bitten. So I'm turning into the BBC, British.
Yeah.
The British do have enough ships to send a credible naval force.
Yes.
So these are destroyers and aircraft carriers, but also requisitioned ferries that are carrying the troops.
Well, cruise ships. So basically cruise the ships. Two biggest. Yeah. So you've got two aircraft carriers that go, which are Hermes and Invincible, the two aircraft carriers that John Knott had wanted to scrap. And then they requisition the Canberra, which is, I think, a P&O liner. And they're going to put on, the Canberra is going to have the Vanguard, which is called 3 Commando Brigade, which has got three Royal Marine battalions and two paratrooper battalions. So that's about 3,000 to 4,000 men. And they're going to be taken on the Canberra. So you have, but you've also got all these support ships. So, you know, it's a sort of fleet. It's a D-Day style fleet because the logistics obviously are the Falklands are in the middle of nowhere. You have to take everything with you.
Yeah.
So there's this huge armada.
Well, there's Ascension Island, isn't there, in the middle of the Atlantic.
So Ascension Island is in the middle of the Atlantic. Yeah, that's British, but it has an American base on it. We've leased a base.
Yeah.
So we need the Americans on side.
Right. So the task force sets off. There's a kind of growing sense of patriotism, and I guess that some people would say jingoism, and that sense of a division. I mean, it's not as strong as you get, say, with the Brexit vote. But there are certain kind of parallels there, I guess.
Oh, definitely. Tom.
That are definitely expressed through a wonderful collection of essays by Britain's writers. So Polly Toynbee, the Guardian columnist, and Margaret Drabble, the Hampstead novelist, and Salman Rushdie, of course.
It's called Authors Take Sides on the Falklands. Yeah. It was done one from the Spanish Civil War.
So they're all against the task force.
Oh, it's brilliant, actually.
But my favourite one that you quote is Jilly Cooper, author of Bonkbuster novels.
She clearly sends her contribution in late because the war looks like it's already happened.
So I have to confess, some of these Argentinian officers are so frightfully good looking. One might almost enjoy being taken prisoner by them.
Yeah, of course.
So that's her take on it.
But all the others that you mentioned, like Rushdie, Polly Toynbee, Margaret Drabble, it's not just that they're against it, Tom. And this is how it does preview the Brexit argument. It is that they think, they find it utterly unthinkable.
And it's embarrassing and vulgar. Yeah.
But it's also turns on their head, on its head, everything they had thought about what Britain was. And they had thought that Britain had turned its back on this sort of stuff.
You've got this fabulous quote, again, from your book, from Jonathan Raban, fabulous travel writer. I'd heard Britain talking in a dream, he says, after watching the task force set sail. And what it was saying scared me stiff.
Yeah.
Although part of the reason I think why he's scared stiff is that he actually finds himself moved by it, doesn't he?
I think that's what's so brilliant. So do you know the brilliant thing about the Falklands from a historian's point of view is that spring, two different brilliant travel writers that had the same idea. Paul Theroux was one and Jonathan Raban was the other. And they both had the idea of sailing around the coast of the island of Great Britain and kind of and dropping in at kind of seaside towns and writing about, I guess, largely for an American audience, about what they found. And I think they both thought of this idea independently as Britain is a declining nation. You know, it'll be old pensioners moaning about inflation and stuff and the empire having gone. And they both set off on sort of different routes. And the war breaks out while they're doing it. So, yeah. And the most amazing, Jonathan Raban's book is called Sailing. And there's this, as you, I'm so glad you mentioned this because it's an amazing section where he talks about watching. He's on his boat and he's watching the task force sailing on a little sort of black and white telly or something. And his brain thinks it's ridiculous. We shouldn't be doing this.
But his heart is going.
Yeah. And then he notices that he's crying, you know, with emotion at the sort of the anthem singing and all that sort of stuff. And I think you're absolutely right that there's a very much a kind of Brexit-ish divide. Although it's different because in this case,
it's about much larger.
80% of the public are all for it. And the polls suggest that, I think the most amazing polls say that 4 out of 10 people wanted Britain to just stop bombing Argentina straight away. And 2 out of 10 people thought Britain should invade Argentina
itself.
So, you know, the public.
That's the Aaron Banks equivalent of.
Exactly.
Okay, we should, I think, take a break at this point. And when we come back, as the task force steams its way across the Atlantic, let's look at the international context, because that becomes very important.
Okay.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. We are in the heart of the Falklands War now. The task force has set sail. And of course, this is very much an international conflict. I mean, I think people around the world, governments around the world, are looking in a certain degree of perplexity as Britain launches what seems, well, I mean, it is basically a colonial war. And within Britain, Dominic, the context for this is that John Knott has stayed in position, but Lord Carrington has resigned. Is that right?
That's right. John Knott wanted to resign, but Mrs. Thatcher wouldn't let him. And he really resented that because he thought it made
him dishonorable. So John Knott's the Defence Secretary.
But the Foreign Secretary, Lord Carrington, who ironically was the one person who had foreseen the invasion and said, we have to be, you know, we have to watch out for this. He nevertheless, because he's out of this sort of sense of honour, he falls on his sword. So it is a very honourable thing.
And so he gets replaced by Francis Pym.
Who Mrs. Thatcher hates.
But who's another war hero, right?
Who is, indeed, yes.
But he looks, he's a kind of, he's one of those slimy looking Tory Etonians.
Well, they're all pretty slimy looking. No, but
he looks particularly slimy.
But he's got shares in Brill Cream, clearly.
And he is, I mean, he's the likeliest to succeed Thatcher if she falls.
Yes, probably.
So she's a bit twitchy about having
Absolutely.
Him on board.
Yeah.
And also he's a little bit wetter.
He is a bit wetter.
Than Thatcher or not.
Although Tom, her reputation in this regard is massively caricatured. You see, the common image we can get later into the and probably a subsequent episode about the electoral impact of all this, but the image of Mrs. Thatcher that she herself colluded in, the Iron Lady image, unbending, determined, bent on war. You know, we will not talk, we will fight. All this sort of idea is utterly at variance with the documentary record, with
the
archival reality. Well, it's very clear that from the beginning, she was open to compromise, that the British government was open to compromise and was actually very keen on the idea of compromise. Now, they didn't want to admit this later on, because particularly when the war was won, all mention of this was basically banished. But so right away, it's obvious that Britain cannot succeed without international support. So the first thing they do, which is really smart, is straight away the first weekend, the Britain's ambassador to the United Nations, Sir Anthony Parsons, gets the Security Council to approve a resolution. I think it's 502, that they want the Argentines to withdraw from the islands.
And that passes.
And that passes.
Because the Soviet ambassador says to Anthony Parsons, you deserve the garter for that.
Yeah, exactly. Does. Very good. Nice thing for the Soviet ambassador. So the Soviet Union abstain because they hate Argentina and Britain equally, as do China. So the resolution passes. Now, the amazing thing about this is the Argentine regime, the Galtieri regime, which we talked about in the last episode, is so incompetent. They haven't really planned for the aftermath at all. I think because they just think Britain will accept it as a fait accompli. So they've lined up no diplomatic support. They have nothing. They have no real case. They are just utterly passive. So the British get this UN resolution. So the British have the UN.
Right. But and there are three key countries in this drama. The first we mentioned in the first episode, which is Argentina's bitterest enemy, Chile.
Yeah.
And so Chile's kind of readiness to help Britain, is that on the basis of, you know,
hatred of Argentina?
My enemy's enemy is my friend.
Exactly, yeah. So the Chileans, so there were sort of economic links between the Thatcher government and the Pinochet government, because they're obviously both embarked on monetarist experiments. So their particular style of kind of economic reform.
But the Pinochet government is also into the whole kind of attaching electrodes to
absolutely
folk singers and
they're very
poets and things.
They're very keen. Yes. They're very keen on domestic repression, but you know, the British government has no problem with that, because they're our Cold War allies. That's how they perceive it. And the Chileans basically say, we'll give you our intelligence, we'll allow you to base, you know, the RAF can have a sort of informal use of a Chilean base. I think they just use that for surveillance and stuff. So, you know, everything that we know, you can have any kind of logistical support. It can't be done publicly because it breaks the kind of code of South American solidarity. But, you know, we'll give you.
And so looking very, very far ahead, that's why when Pinochet gets exiled and comes to Britain, Mrs. Thatcher goes for tea with him.
Yeah, when he's put under. Exactly. Yeah.
OK, so that's the context for that.
The general was very staunch, Tom.
Right. So even though it's a crucial part of the British propaganda effort to point out that Argentina is a repressive, fascistic military junta, when it comes to Chile, they're our repressive, fascistic military.
Yeah, that's fair. Right. I mean, to be fair, just on the Argentines. So the Argentines, another one of their things, that they're completely inept at public relations. So the guy they've got commanding their troops in South Georgia is a man called, I think his name is Alfredo Astiz, a lieutenant, and his nickname is the Blonde Angel of Death.
Yeah, that's not good.
Because of his record of murdering nuns. So I think he's probably not the person that the Argentines, from a PR point of view, should have had in charge of that part of the operation. Anyway, sorry, Tom.
Okay, so that's Chile.
Yeah.
And then there's another country led by the man who Mrs. Thatcher described as the staunchest of our friends.
Now, nobody would expect this.
And regular listeners who have heard your opinion on the country that this man led may be surprised to learn the identity of this man, and it was none other than President François Mitterrand.
The French were very staunch, Tom.
So good to hear that.
Mitterrand rang Mrs. Thatcher. He was the first foreign leader to ring her, and he basically said to her, France is with you. We will give you everything you need. You will have our unstinting support, and he meant it.
And do you think, why is that?
Oh, it's because France can't have regimes
nicking islands,
yeah.
Nicking colonial
islands. Yeah, they've got loads of them.
Is that basically the reason then?
I think it's pretty much the reason. It's also, yes, I think it is pretty much the reason.
They might lose Guadeloupe or...
Right, I think... Yeah. So what has happened is that the French are one of the biggest military providers to Argentina. So they have provided them...
Exocets.
Exocet missiles. And super étendard planes. So... battle standard planes, I suppose you would call super battle standard planes. And Mitterrand says, basically, we'll give you all the specs on all the stuff we've sold to Argentina, so you'll know exactly how they work and all that stuff. And we will not sell any more, obviously not to Argentina, but we also won't. We've got a deal lined up with Peru, and we will suspend that because the Peruvians might give some to Argentina. Yeah. So that's an unusual case, actually, of, you know, a sort of European competitor, basically saying we will put our friendship with you above our own commercial self-interest. It's very striking. Mrs. Thatcher was always incredibly, even though she still kind of gave Mitterrand a handbagging at European summits, she was incredibly grateful to Mitterrand for this. Mm. But again, the weird thing is, it wasn't massively publicized, and the British public just didn't want to believe it, so it didn't enter into the imagination at all.
But Mitterrand was quite keen on her, wasn't she? Eyes of Caligula and the mouth of Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah, he was. Famous. He was, and she was very keen on him. She liked Mitterrand. She liked. So she didn't mind. You know, people's politics was irrelevant in some ways. The more lounge lizard like they were, yes. The more Mrs. Yes. Thatcher liked them.
Yes. Yes.
So you know, Mitterrand loves him. Reagan loves him. Helmut Kohl, who's
sausage eater. Yes. Yeah,
absolutely not.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, you mentioned Reagan. So Reagan is obviously, the United States is obviously probably the most important.
Yeah, it is the most
and
important.
And the United States, in its response to the Falklands War, is split. It because is. Britain is America's closest ally in NATO. But Argentina is a kind of key bulwark of democracy, as it's seen, even though it's a fascistic dictatorship. Yeah. And the figure who is the American figure who is keenest on backing Argentina over Britain is Jean Fitzpatrick,
Kirkpatrick,
who is the ambassador to the UN, the US
well,
ambassador.
Yes,
to the UN.
Exactly. So she's a kind of neoconservative. Jean Kirkpatrick was famous because she's very strong anti-communist, and she had written a big sort of thesis about the difference between totalitarian and authoritarian dictatorships. And she said, yeah, authoritarian dictatorships absolutely splendid. Totalitarian dictatorships are terrible. And we should back Argentina in this dispute. South America is very important to us. The British are kind of yesterday's men. Who cares about them? And she is basically, you know, shouted down by the rest of the Reagan administration. His Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, very pro-British, basically says
he ends up getting a knighthood, right?
He does. And he basically says to the people at the Pentagon, give the Brits whatever you want, whatever they want. Reagan is sort of on the fence because he's having to referee these competing factions within the administration. But Reagan's heart is very pro-British. You know, he wants to back the British. And when he finally does get off the fence, he's actually pretty
but,
kind of.
But he's sitting on the fence while his Secretary of State, Al Haig, is jetting from Washington to London to Buenos Aires, this way and that, trying to patch up some kind of compromise. And this is the context for what you were saying about Mrs. Thatcher not being as dogmatically set on war as... because I guess subsequently every side has an interest in portraying her like that.
You know,
she does because it casts her as the Iron Lady. Her enemies, her opponents can because it casts her as kind of uncaring and inflexible. But actually, she is more open to negotiation than the myth would suggest.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, Al Haig is a man with an ego the size of the moon, and he basically says, I will personally ensure there is no war. And he does this subtle diplomacy, like his old boss, Henry Kissinger, had done in the 70s. And he comes to Britain, and he basically can get a deal with the British. And the deal is that both sides will withdraw. So the British will agree not to send their fleet too close to the Falklands. The Argentines will withdraw their troops. And then the islands, I mean, there are various iterations of this deal, but basically the islands will be administered for the time being by a kind of international condominium, different powers, maybe Britain and Argentina, two of them. And in that, for the next 2 years, and in that time, they'll come to a deal on the sovereignty of the islands. Almost certainly, I think, Tom, that deal would have involved Argentina getting the sovereignty. Because I can't see there's any other compromise that they could possibly have accepted. And the really remarkable thing is that, for example, 14th of April, Mrs. Thatcher tells her cabinet, we have to accept Haig's deal. You know, we have to compromise. And this is not the first time she does this, by the way. And it's, you know, again, this is, as you said, it's not well known. Mrs. Thatcher herself doesn't trumpet this later on, so it gets forgotten.
So does she talk about it in her memoirs?
She does, but she talks about it in a very evasive,
shadowy way.
Haig takes the deal, he goes off to Buenos Aires, and the Argentines say no. And this is the interesting thing, because Britain can be seen to compromise. It's very embarrassing for Mrs. Thatcher. It would have robbed her of that sort of romantic, patriotic role that she was to play.
Elizabeth
I at Tilbury, exactly, or sort of Boudicca. But she could have done it. She could have said, we compromised and we avoided a war. it's absolutely impossible for the Argentines to compromise because all they have is nationalism in their locker. You know, they've sent to send their troops and then have to withdraw their troops after they've had crowds on the streets of Buenos Aires cheering and waving Argentine flags would be humiliating for them. And they're completely intransigent. Haig says to them, I mean, Haig says to them at one point, if you'll forgive my language, he says to his aides, the whole thing is a charade, a fucking charade. These guys are diddling me. This is about Argentina. And then he basically says to Galtieri, we know exactly what he says. He says in the final meeting, within a matter of days, the British fleet will be upon you. Those forces are capable of inflicting severe damage on yours. I don't for one moment question Argentine courage, but it cannot prevent your systematic defeat by sophisticated British surface, subsurface and air power. Blah, blah, blah. The British will not bear the onus because you were the first to use force and they made a reasonable effort to reach a peaceful settlement. There is no escaping the historical responsibility for what now seems inevitable. He says this to Galtieri. Galtieri still says no, because the Argentines also just have it in mind that the British will crumble because of the weather, that they'll lose some ships, that they'll be able to. And all
do you
the
think,
time.
And do you think, what's their take on Mrs. Thatcher? Do they feel because she's a woman, therefore.
I'm sure.
Do they feel kind of threatened by her? That, well, you know, they don't want to. Or do they think, you know, she'll burst into tears and
I
run
suspect,
away? Or,
you know, Argentina is not a country in sort of 70s, 80s Argentina. Is
no,
not
it's
a country
not a feminist.
Renowned for
stronghold.
Its sort of progressive gender politics. And I think, particularly in the army. And I think. Undoubtedly, they would despise her because she's a woman. They despise Britain for having a woman leader, and they see that as part of a sort of enfeeblement. But also, they in the Argentine press, they present it always as, have you ever see these covers of these magazines, Tom? They're amazing. They always portray her with an eye patch as a pirate. And there's a brilliant, I can't remember what the periodical is, but we reproduced it in my book, Who Dares Wins, in color. It has a picture of Mrs. Thatcher, and it says, pirata, bruja, assassina, pirate.
Culpable.
Yeah, guilty. Yeah. Pirate, witch, and assassin. And they.
I'm looking at them now. There's one where it's a photo of her, and they photoshopped on an eye patch. But there's one as a fabulous drawing of her looking very, very kind of haggard and crone-like almost with a pirate's kind of hat on, and she's fingering a sword.
Yeah,
she's got a pirate's hat with a skull and crossbones.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. Well, I must try and put that on the.
You should do,
On the tweet advertising this. That's excellent. But Dominic, something that you say in the book, the fact that Mrs. Thatcher was not a man proved an enormous asset. So what do you mean by that? So that's in the context of the British cabinet, is it?
So the way she normally handles her business is she's incredibly interfering and bossy, and basically thinks she knows everybody else's business better than theirs. But this is the one thing that she knows nothing at all about. And nobody expects her to know about it. So she doesn't have a chip on her shoulder about it. In a funny, you know, no one could possibly expect her to know about tanks and planes and submarines.
But she gets rather keen on military men.
She loves military men. She loves listening to them. She doesn't feel she has to compete with them as she does with economists or with her own, particularly her own ministers who she loves to bully. So for once, I think in her entire career in government, she's actually, everybody says she listens. You know, she takes advice. She's very sensible. She doesn't ever interfere. She just lets us get on with it. She gives us clear answers. I mean, all the people who worked with her, all the military men, who often many of them had previously absolutely despised her, they say, oh, she was a dream to work with, you know, very decisive and let us get on with it. Now, had she been the other thing is, I suppose you could say, had she been a man with experience of war, like so many of, they all knew, I mean, they said, we know what can go wrong. She didn't. And that meant that she was ready to go for it.
And so readier to trust men in braid.
Oh, she loved men in braid. Yeah, she loved them.
When they say, yes, we can do this. And Dominic, to be fair, it does go well. So the task force does reach the South Atlantic after what, 9 weeks, is it?
No, it's 3 weeks.
Oh, 3 weeks. That long.
Well,
that shorter time.
Well, no, it's Henry Leach had said to her, she said, how long will it take to get ready the task force? He said, it'll take 3 days. And she said, how long to get to the Falklands? And he said, 3 weeks. She said, you mean 3 days? And he said, no, I mean 3 weeks. Like, it takes ages to get to the Falklands. So they sail at the beginning of April. They get to Ascension Island on the 19th of April. They don't land until towards the end of May. So it is actually, Tom, you were right, actually. It's a very, very long protracted. I mean, they sort of, they have to allow time for the diplomatic process to play out and for everybody to catch up in the fleet. So it's a, it's weeks. So for weeks, actually, nothing really is happening. The task force is just, it's a 10-week campaign all in all. But for most of that time, the task force is just kind of plowing through the waves.
So it's a bit like a test match.
It's kind of
long periods and then sudden explosive action.
Well, except that there's no action at all to start with, because basically all that's happening is these blokes are on the ships sunbathing and they're just sort of limbering up. But it all doesn't, at that point, it doesn't really seem real. So a lot of the soldiers are saying, well, you know, are we actually going to do any fighting? Will we get back in time for the World Cup, which is happening in Spain that summer?
But Dominic, one thing that does happen is we mentioned South Georgia in the first episode.
Scrap metal.
The scrap metal behaved disgracefully by barbecuing a reindeer. And this is the first clash between British and Argentine forces, and it's a total British victory, right?
Well, although it's a bit more dramatic than that, Tom.
So a few helicopters go blown up and things.
So I think I said before, the 16th of April, the first aircraft carriers got to Ascension Island. And at that point, there are 127 ships in the fleet. So it's a bloody big fleet. And there's about 10,000 men. And when they get to Ascension Island, they divide off 150 Royal Marines and 70 men from the SAS. And they're basically going to go off to South Georgia, which is, you know, as we said before, hundreds of miles away from the Falkland Islands. It's really important that the government gets an early sort of
victory.
But South Georgia, you know, it's practically, you're virtually in Antarctica, or you're getting on the way to Antarctica. So when the first helicopters go, 21st of April, they drop these blokes. They're on a glacier. The tents blow away. It's kind of Shackleton, the Terror style, kind of freezing
monsters, freezing lurching up out of
freezing
holes
conditions.
In the ice.
Yeah. Basically, the most of the tents are blown away. There's got about a couple of tents left, and they're all. Some of the men are in the tents, and the other men are trying to shovel snow away, and it's just awful. And they basically have to radio and say, "Come and get us. This isn't going to work at all." The helicopters then crash. Mrs. Thatcher gets the news the helicopters crash, and she thinks the men are dead. So she bursts into, you know, she starts crying. It's the first moment of casualty. It's the first operation, really, of the war, and it's all gone wrong. And then she gets the news that a third helicopter has got there and got them out, and she's absolutely on cloud nine. And I think that that's a real psychological turning point for her, because that really emboldens her. In future, she's going to be much less keen on peace. She starts to identify with the men in this slightly sort
of... Our boys.
Yeah, our boys, our brave boys, our lads, all that sort of stuff from that point onwards. Then on the 25th, which is a Sunday, Mrs. Thatcher's at Chequers, and she gets the news that they're going to try the operation again. This time it all goes absolutely splendidly. They attack an Argentine submarine, which is at South Georgia, called the Santa Fe, and they cripple it. The British commandos kind of arrive. The Argentines don't even fire a shot. They just basically give up completely straight away. The scrap metal...
So are they conscripts?
Yeah, they are. Almost all the Argentine... I mean, there are obviously some professional troops, but a large proportion of the troops in the Argentine army...
Because if you're a conscript, you wouldn't want to take on the SAS, would you?
No, I mean, young guys. I mean, boys, basically, from Buenos Aires, who are in this freezing place. They've no idea where they are. Bloody awful. There's a load of scrap metal dealers. And suddenly the SAS pitch up. So they surrender. And so that night, there is this incredibly dramatic moment. Are you going to give us a rendition of that, Tom? Or is that...
No, I'm not. I think we're going to stop at this point.
Oh, no, that is a cliffhanger.
So that's a cliffhanger. So
a lot of people won't be able to sleep. They won't be able to sleep with excitement.
Well, in that case, they'll have to join the members club, won't they?
Very good. The rest is historypod.com.
We will kick off with my sensational impression of Mrs. Thatcher's response to the triumph at South Georgia. And then we will look at the task force moving in the Falklands, the sinking of the Belgrano, the sinking of HMS Sheffield, the press reaction in Britain, which is extraordinary, and then how Britain ends up taking the Falklands back.
Hasta luego.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.